several miles off the main highway, tucked away in a secluded canyon on prime vineyard property, stands a rustic barn that was built many decades before the vines around it were planted. In that barn, a sophisticated broadcast and recording studio has been built. The barn also has a well-hidden root cellar stocked with many of the world's most exceptional wines, only to be shared with guests who secretly come to offer their insights and tell their stories. Guests are sworn to secrecy and are shuttled to the studio aboard a John Deere tractor. Those who cannot make the journey in person are interviewed by satellite hookup, and sometimes the crew simply sneaks away with microphones in hand and interviews guests in barrel rooms, wine cellars, and other magical places. All of this is done like clockwork every single week, so that we can bring you another episode of Grape Encounters Radio.
Peel me a grape, crush me some ice, skin me a peach, save the fuzz for my pillow.
And it is time for your grape encounter of the week. And I'm in the vineyards of one of my absolute favorite winemakers, really not just in our area where I live, but really in the world. He's one of the most fascinating people to talk to. His name is Christian Roganon. He is the winemaker at the Niven Family Wine Estate.
Hello, David. Great to be with you today. And what a beautiful day. A little bit of overcast, but I can see all around us the beautiful white flowers showing that we got so much rain this year. Great to be with you. And I'm looking forward to the segment as always.
And once again, you're doing that fantastic fake French accent that everybody loves so much. No, that's the real deal. You're the boy from Dijon.
When I was in my 20s, I decided to go for the big dive and just grab an airplane ticket and two suitcases, a dictionary, $500, and move to the United States. And I thought, you know, in the U.S., they're really more and more into better food. Restaurants are making, you know, better dishes. And when you have better food, wine will follow. And I was right. Really, the last 30 years, it has been extraordinary. The wine scene really has changed. And I'm really so glad to be part of it.
And you have had the opportunity to work underneath or side by side or with some of the greatest winemakers in the world. Every time I throw out a name with you in idle conversation, you say, oh, I know him. I worked with him. It's amazing. You've been very blessed in that respect, haven't you?
Yeah, I had the chance to make wine in five continents. And one of the most interesting things that I ever did was to plant the first vineyards in South Korea for the 1980 Olympics.
No kidding.
In Seoul, they had all the head of states where for their inaugural of the Olympics, and I was really the lucky winner to be the person that the consulting to make a sparkling wine for that occasion. The wine was not very good because we had monsoon during harvest. It was in the south part of the country, in south of Busan, but it had nice bubbles and everybody seems to be happy. Ronald Reagan was sipping the wine, and I sure did not tell him the wine was not very good, but it was one of my greatest memories.
He seemed to be enjoying it.
He did, indeed.
Was the wine capable of being good? I mean, in other words, if conditions were right and the weather, there had not been a monsoon, would we have had some great wine?
It's very challenging to make wine in that part of the world. They simply have so much monsoon in August, July and August. It's just the rainy season and it's just tropical weather and it's not conducive for good grape growing. But it was fun. It was a great memory and I'm so happy to be the person chosen for that project.
So we're going to be talking about some interesting wines today, going down a road that we haven't been down, I think, for a while at least. But I want you to tell just a little bit about the operation that you work with, because it's really, really making some amazing wines under a number of different labels. You've got well over 1,000 acres that you cultivate here and just wonderful wines.
Yeah, absolutely, David. And I'm very fortunate to have met the Niven family many, many decades ago. And they really made a huge commitment on growing the right grapes at the right place and the right condition. And just less than 20 years ago, just about, we built the facility in here on Orchard Road, just south of San Luis Obispo, and we have 1,000 acres of vineyards. And the family is very interested into the future of the wine industry, and for that reason, we're growing some varietals that are less familiar to our listeners, such as Gruner Veltliner, Albarino, Grenache Blanc, some of those new upcoming varietals. And it's very exciting because I think many people now want to try a new wine. Wine is very popular, it's very enticing, and there is a need to discover new varietals, and we want to be part of that in the Central Coast in San Luis Obispo.
So this is a huge point that you make, because probably if we went back 20 years ago, the idea of discovery, it didn't even exist, because we knew what we wanted. We wanted one of the 8 or 9 most famous wines. That's what we had acclimated ourselves to. We were insistent upon, I'm going to have that Cabernet, or I'm going to have my Chardonnay. And now as the baby boomers move out and become less important to the wine industry, not that they're not important, but you now have the millennials coming in, they have a completely different mindset, don't they?
Yeah, I think I would attribute that to two different things. One is the internet. Obviously, the world is on our feet with the internet. And then traveling. I mean, there's so many Americans that I've met that have been to Europe, they've been to Australia, New Zealand. So as they travel, they discover new varietals, different types of wine. And when they go home, they want to reiterate that kind of same experience. And I think they just want to try new things. I mean, we all want to have an exciting life. And if you drink the same types of wine all the time, it's boring. People want new things. The act of discovery, that's what's fun. It's just new things are exciting.
And what has been very interesting, I think, over the past 10 years is how different wines come into the limelight. As an example, the question I've been asking recently is, what wines do you think are going to be in vogue over the next couple of years and really move into the limelight? One that we talked about the last week or so is Cab Franc. Actually, I talk about Cab Franc every week because I love Cab Franc. I'm just stuck on Cab Franc right now. I'm going through a Cab Franc thing. But there are certainly a number of wines that are moving into the limelight. So if I ask that question to you, you mentioned a few, Albarino and Gruner. Where are you putting your money and your effort when it comes to predicting what people are going to be looking for over the next couple of years?
Well, you have the standard core of the varietals that has been there forever. And I give you an example. 50% of white wine drink in the United States are Chardonnay. So there is an enormous market. You cannot ignore this market. Just to put in perspective, there is 100,000 acres of Chardonnay grown in the state. We were talking about Albarino. There's less than 200. So it's an enormous difference.
You're saying 200 acres?
195 acres to be exact in production.
In the whole state of California?
That's correct. Of Albarino, it's minuscule compared to Chardonnay, but it's growing. And then once again, there's that interest. You know, as we have more and more food into this country now, every city has Vietnamese food, Japanese food. We have, I think, a more world of discovery once again. And as the frontiers and faraway distance are getting closer to us, I think we more and more want to discover those new things. And we're part of that. This is why we are actually the largest producer of Albarino and Gruner Veltliner, not only in the county, but in the state today. And I believe we're proud of it. We have had extraordinary accolade. I give you an example. In the tasting in Spain, it's called the Bacchus Wine Tasting. Last year, only 5 Albarino got awarded a gold medal. We, you know, entered our wine, and we were one of the 5. So we not only have those great varietals, but we now can make wine that is so into the vein, into the flavor of that varietal. They're very varietal correct, so to speak, that we can be in San Luis Obispo County now make those great weight wine that are among the very best. It's really the case. And when you talk about Gruner Veltliner, there's a tasting that takes place every single year in 4 different cities in Europe, and we're generally within the top 10 best producer. So there's no questions, and we, with the appropriate wine growing technique, the appropriate winemaking decisions and strategy, we can really make those great wines.
We're getting a little breeze out here now. Tell me about the structure that we're sitting under, because I took it for granted when we sat down here. You brought out crackers and cheese and bubbly and some Albarino. Delicious, from Tangent. You can get that all over the world. All over the country, I should say, for sure, right?
Yes, we are the largest producer in Albarino in the state. We are the main producer, and we take that varietal very, very seriously. And as you mentioned, David, we are sitting under pergola. Pergola is almost like a little roof up above us, actually made from the foliage from Albarino. Albarino is one of the most vigorous varietal of any grape grown in the world.
So this is called a pergola, and it is a large structure, and these vines are growing, what, 20 feet, 30 feet?
Yes, they can.
Wow.
And they're almost like trees. When you see Albarino vines that are over 100 years old, they can carry up to 500 pounds of fruit. And truly, they are a tree. In fact, when you travel in Spain, you would see on the road in September, people climbing a ladder to harvest albariño trellised with the use of a tree. So they plant the varietals at the base of a tree, and the vine goes up and up and up and up the trees and up to 15, 20 feet, and then you need a ladder to harvest it, which is kind of funny and interesting.
Christian Roganon is my guest today. He is the winemaker at Niven Family Wine Estate. They make amazing wines under a number of different labels. You can just Google Niven and you will find them. That's the easiest way. But we're going to come back and talk more. This is one of my favorite people to talk to, because if he don't know it, it didn't happen. And that's just how it is. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this.
At Grape Encounters, we're all about sharing. That's why it would be a crying shame if you didn't join our Facebook group page. Just search for Grape Encounters Radio on Facebook. It's where we're constantly sharing the latest wine news and information while you're waiting for your next episode of Grape Encounters. David will be right back as soon as he's through unfriending anyone who doesn't love wine. Oh, I guess it's going to be a very short break.
We like to talk about wine.
This segment of Grape Encounters is brought to you by my number one wine discovery of 2016, the awesome gold medal winning wines of the Cardello Winery. From the very first sip, you'll understand why these astounding, nicely priced Cardello wines are swiftly becoming a cult classic, just as I predicted. Handcrafted and stunning, you can get yours at CardelloWinery.com. That's CardelloWinery.com. Or find more information at GrapeEncounters.com.
Roll out the barrel. We'll have the
And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
Roll out the barrel.
We are back with Grape Encounters Radio. What a privilege. What a great time to be sitting under the Albariño pergola at the tasting rooms for Niven Family Wine Estate with Christian Roganon, who is the winemaker. You've been here forever, since day one.
Yes, absolutely. That was my dream come true wish. I always wanted to design a winery from scratch, and the Niven family just gave me that extraordinary opportunity with, I wouldn't say an open checkbook, but just about. We were able to design a gravity-fed winery, and we have all the equipment we need, and it's excellent fruit from the Etna Valley, 5 miles from the ocean, and it's really an honor for me to be able to have access to all that great equipment and work with one of the best fruit in the state.
So how does that happen, that you meet this family, they open up the checkbook, they say, oh, go build us a winery, go make the best wines in the world, you can just take care of this and we'll check back with you later? That doesn't happen to me, to be honest with you.
I've been actually in the Central Coast for 32 years now, and it's a very tight and small community. Everybody knows one another. And then I had the chance to meet the Niven family, you know, decades ago, and we became friends. And I remember playing croquet with them 20 years ago before I was even an employee at their house. So there's some friendship that got built, and I just didn't want to leave the Central Coast. When I had the opportunity to move from the Leticia winery to this winery here, I decided to stay here versus going to Napa Valley or Sonoma. It was just, I just felt comfortable in here.
And you mentioned Leticia. You and Leticia are two of the very best sparkling winemakers, certainly in this area. I have great respect for them as well, but I just love the fact that we're making more and more sparkling in this region. What's the demand like for bubbly from your perspective? Are you getting more and more call for it? Are you able to meet the demand? Is it going to continue to grow? What do you think?
Well, in the last 10 years, it really has been an explosion of sparkling wine around the world. There is probably at least 50 to 60 countries now that are making sparkling wine. It's just something, as the wine production increases, there's more and more demand for wine. I think sparkling wine is a category that is growing tremendously. And as Napoleon said once long, long ago, in victory, you need champagne to celebrate. In defeat, you need it to feel better. So regardless of your state of mind, you always enjoy sparkling wine, regardless of the occasion, if it's to feel better or just the celebration. situation.
Has the world finally discovered also that champagne is not just for New Year's Eve and Valentine's Day?
I think more and more people definitely are doing that. I think now integrate the consumption of sparkling wine with food. In fact, sparkling wine is very, very good with grilled fish, with even chicken. And it's just more than just having a slice of cake and a birthday and candles. I mean, sparkling wine is very pleasant, it's refreshing, it has a good acidity, it's a little bit low in alcohol, so it's just a very fun beverage that make people happy.
Well, I'm going to make kind of a parallel here for a second. I probably will get myself in trouble for this, but to me, years ago, sparkling wine was a bit like Passover wine. I often heard my friends of Jewish faith complain that they made these wines and nobody really cared about how good they are, and now today, they make all these fantastic Passover wines. And champagne, it was sort of like if you brought a bottle of bubbly to an occasion, a birthday, for instance, or, you know, just some special event, as long as it had bubbles, it didn't matter if it had quality. And now the quality is everything, and they're making so much good champagne. And, well, I'll call yours sparkling wine, but it's made method champenois, right? You know, so much good wine, and it should be consumed throughout the meal. You don't have to pull out a different wine. And I think people are starting to really get that.
Oh, absolutely. And that it's, you see that now sparkling wine are aged 1, 2, 3 years or more in the bottle. So you get more of the complexity as the wine ages on the yeast. Once again, for our listeners, what makes sparkling wine or champagne very special is the extended period of time when the wine is actually in contact with the yeast. The yeast were added to the wine to create the effervescence, the pressure, the bubbles of the wine. But over time, the yeast used for the carbonation breaks down and release wonderful flavor, some nuttiness, some kind of vanilla, doughy bread, and makes the wine very rich and complex. It's just a lot more than just simply good-looking bubbles out of it. There's a lot of flavor, and as you have more richness and concentration and flavor to the wine, that you can definitely associate it with more food, of course.
Is there a place in your world for cava and prosecco?
Of course, and that's the beauty. Sparkling wine, you don't have to spend a fortune. You can get really good prosecco cavas in the less than $10 range, and it's a delicious wine. They're very good. Prosecco is made from the wine called Glera, which is the varietals. And in Spain, cavas are made from very unique grape, Charello, Parellada, very unique grape that are actually not used in champagne or traditional production of sparkling wine. So you do have unusual varietals in the world of sparkling wine. And because there's so many varietals, I could count probably 20. So you have a really very large array of flavors with sparkling wine. So in anything between, you know, $7, $8 to $100, and you could find really good sparkling wine around $15 or less. They're out there, definitely.
Yeah, and don't be afraid of the word sparkling, but I think you do want to look for that method champenois on,
yes,
especially the California sparkling wines, the New York sparkling wines as well, which are quite good.
Yes.
But as Christian just pointed out, the cavas and the proseccos are really delicious. They're different grapes. And one thing I always like to point out is the fact that if you are not a Pinot fan or a Chardonnay fan, there's probably a good chance you're not a champagne fan either. You might want to try prosecco or cava, because now we're talking about different grapes.
Yes.
And it might be something that you'll find you like a lot better.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to steer them away from your champagne customers, of course.
Well, traditionally, when the wine is fermented within the bottle itself, that's the champagne method, the classic method, then typically you use Chardonnay and Pinot Noir for that. But now we also have wine carbonated in large tanks. It's called the Charmat process, which you have a base wine and you do a fermentation inside a very large vessel, tank under pressure, and then the wine is filtered and bottled following the carbonation. So those are different methods, and the less expensive wines are made with the Charmat process, with fermented in tanks, versus the traditional classical method, the méthode champenoise. It's fermented in each individual bottle, so there's additional costs. The wine is also better, simply because the wine is aged for a longer period of time.
My guest is Christian Roganaugh. He is the winemaker at Niven Family Wine Estate, really one of the best in the Central Coast of California. I always want to say in the Central Coast. It's on the Central Coast of California. Anyway, they do an amazing job, but more than that, Christian is just a wealth of knowledge. And we're going to get you out, and we're going to do a seminar with you, I think, later this year.
I would like that very much. It's always fun to share knowledge and talk about something that I'm so passionate about, which is the world of vineyards and wine.
We're going
to
suck your your brain dry. That's what we're going to do. We'll be back with more Grape Encounters, and we'll do a little of that brain sucking with Christian Rogatov here at Niven Family Wine Estate right after this.
You'll find Grape Encounters Radio located at the corner of Fermented and Demented. You do have a GPS, don't you?
Yeah, wise guy, eh?
Do, 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 do. Wine.
It only takes a taste.
It only takes a taste. When it's something special, it only takes a taste. When you know it's good.
And now, Grape Encounters with David Wilson continues.
You want more of the thing you just got a taste of.
I can't think of a better way to spend a day than to sit under an Albarino pergola with somebody as knowledgeable about wine as Christian Rogatov. We are at the Niven Family Wine Estate. And Christian, am I looking out at all of your vineyards here? Is that what I'm seeing, or are those some of the neighbors as well?
No, really, we're so fortunate to have about 1,000 acres in here with 12 different varietals. We actually make a lot of different wines. We have our Belliana brand, which is a brand dedicated to Burgundian wine, Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, Belliana. Then we have the Tanshan brand, using many of those other vineyards, which is a brand dedicated to alternative white wine varietals, such as Albarino, Grenache Blanc, Viognier, Pinot Gris, and a few others. And also we make a new wine, which is extraordinarily successful. We're very fortunate with that. It's called True Myth. True Myth embodied the grape growing into the Central Coast with a Cabernet from Paso Robles and a Chardonnay from our estate vineyards here in Paragon.
So you mentioned a very interesting term, alternative wines. We live in a world now where we use that word alternative a lot. So to be known as an alternative wine in your company, what would be the criteria?
Well, it's varietals that are not very well known, for instance, compared with Chardonnay, and then also varietals that have a varietal character. When you look at the world of wine, you have two different types of white grapes. You have one type, you taste the berry into the vineyards, and you taste the wine, you have similar flavor. That would be Sauvignon Blanc, it would be Albarino, it would be, you know, Grenache Blanc. So those varietals have a strong varietal character, are typically fermented into stainless, versus other varietal that are not aromatic and that needs oak. That's the case of Chardonnay, Roussanne, Marsanne, Pinot Blanc. Those varietals do not have a very strong varietal character, so they need oak. And those are really the two biggest great families of the world of white varietals in the grape growing.
So as you talk about oak, is oak becoming more important or less important on balance in the wine world?
Well, for those varietals that do not have a varietal character, we mentioned Chardonnay is the main one, you really need oak. I know there is a very popular style now of an oak Chardonnay, but truly Chardonnay is better with oak. It's simply because you don't have a varietal character. The aromatics of Chardonnay are going to come from the fermentation itself, the aging with the yeast after fermentation, but really the oak embellish the wine with contribution of vanilla, cinnamon, wood flavor, oaky flavor, and just make the wine a lot more interesting.
So we need the oak, but we don't want to over-oak it either, though. It seems like there are three Chardonnays today. There's the very oaky, there's the mildly oaky, and then there's the stainless steel.
That's really is really what it is, and there is historical reason for that. When you look at the production of Chardonnay, let's say 40, 50 years ago, Chardonnay was almost unknown in the state. It was simply because there were diseases and production issues with Chardonnay, so it was not really well used. I mean, you look at in 1960, there is something like 400 or 500 acres of Chardonnay in the entire state, versus now there's over 100,000. And the material we have in the vineyards was we had more acidic varietals as Chardonnay. So in order to dress up the wine in the 70s and 80s, most winemakers used a lot of oak to make the wine more interesting because the Chardonnay grapes available back then were not very flavorful. Now with all the selection of cuttings from France, particularly Burgundy, we have now 50 different types of clones, as we call them, of Chardonnay. And some of them are much more aromatic, are more flavors. And then the wine by itself is a lot more interesting. So you don't need as much oak. But there is still the old style of the 70s and 80s oaky Chardonnay. Some people still like this.
I mean, literally, there was a revolt after a while.
Yes, yes.
I mean, people said, enough, it's too much. And then there was this reversion back to, you know, pretty much unoaked stainless Chardonnays. And now we're somewhere in the middle, it feels like.
Yes, unless you have a very unique site when you can have a lot of minerality, steeliness to the Chardonnay, oak is really needed. And I think in today's world, when you ferment your Chardonnay juice with 20 to 30% brand new French oak, you really start to get some of those really exciting flavors of, you know, brings nuttiness, bring the vanilla, bring the cinnamon. Once again, those really good flavors. And it really dresses up the wine significantly. So oak has to be part of the wine. In fact, shouldn't really taste the oak. It should be part of the complexity. Oak should be used as a spice, the same way you use spice right. for cooking.
Okay, so you told me something very interesting that I hadn't really thought about before, and that is the genealogy of Chardonnay. And, you know, I think most people just believe that or have learned that Chardonnay was just there. But that's not the case at all.
Yeah, Chardonnay is actually man-made varietals that started, you know, 500-600 years ago. Nobody knows really when. But the parents used for Chardonnay to do the pollinization was actually a Pinot Noir and then another varietal from Croatia, which is very known by most people, is Gouet Blanc. So the cross of Gouet Blanc and Pinot Noir created 500-600 years ago that new varietal called Chardonnay.
So does this explain why where there's good Pinot Noir, there's good Chardonnay? You always see them paired together, or mostly you do.
Well, they do like the same weather pattern, which is they don't like a lot of heat. They're not very vigorous. This seems to ripen at the same time. The bud break is pretty much the same, very similar Chardonnay slightly later. They kind of require the same kind of care in the vineyards and attention. And they ripen, you know, within a couple of weeks of one another. So they belong together.
Who's first to ripen?
Pinot Noir and then Chardonnay, always.
It's always that way.
Yes.
Never happens differently.
It's extremely rare. The only way that would happen if you had a bloom situation with Pinot Noir that would be under very bad conditions with very cold weather, a lot of wind, and then it would be really delayed. Typically, it's 95% of the time Pinot Noir is first and then Chardonnay is the second varietal harvested a couple of weeks after.
So let's talk about that other grape that Pinot Noir shacked up with to make Chardonnay.
The Gouet Blanc, yes.
The Gouet Blanc. What has become of that grape?
Well, it's not a very interesting wine. In fact, it didn't have a lot of flavor back in the days, and I've never had the chance to taste it, but from what I have read, it was a varietal that would put a lot of tonnage, a very big producer, not a very interesting wine, and it was mostly wine drunk by the peasants 200, 300, 400 years ago. And Chardonnay is a much more refined, has more elegant flavor, higher acidity, more minerality, and that was the wine of the noble, the aristocracy. So that slowly Gouet Blanc disappeared, and it's just now just a varietal nursery.
You got to plant some, you know? Wouldn't that be just a great story to walk right over there? And by the way, I just have to describe the setting here. We have mountains literally in every direction, but we're in a valley. We're looking out over the vineyards. The tasting room is behind me. We're under this pergola, which is just this canopy made from Albarino grapes. And we'll start seeing clusters pretty soon now, right?
Yes, we estimate the flowering, the vines would be in full flower in about 3 weeks from now from Albarino. And you will see just underneath the pergola, many, many very small cluster getting bigger and bigger, just hanging down from the up above canopy.
Will you actually harvest these grapes too and as well and make wine from them?
No, all the visitors, wine club members and all our fans actually eat them.
Yeah.
I've seen many of them actually climbing on the table and just cutting the clusters and eat them up with cheese or whatever.
A little gluttony. All right, we have like 1 minute left. I just have one quick question for you. We've been talking most of today about the various unusual, you know, sort of, well, we called them alt grapes, okay? But of all the wines out there that are new and up and comers, which one would you put your money on to really be very much in the limelight, under the spotlight in the next couple of years? Who's the favored child at this point in time?
Well, I would say for us two very unique varietal. One is from the Iberic Peninsula, the Albariño, which is grown in the northwest of Spain, in Galicia, and also in northern Portugal. And Albariño is a fantastic varietal. They call it in Spain El Vino del Mar because the wine has a little bit of a salty quality to it. So we're selling now a few thousand cases, and the Tangente Albariño is a very refreshing, good minerality. It's just a really delicious wine with seafood. And then, of course, the other varietals which we grow from originally from Austria, which is a Grüner Veltliner, which is a little bit of fuller, richer, rounder wine. And those two varietals seems to be paired with many, many different types of food. We mentioned seafood and Albariño, and if you like cured meat salad with Grüner Veltliner, it's a really interesting choice. In fact, if you had the chance to go to Vienna in summer, you would see at the terrace of many, many cafes people having prosciutto and a glass of Grüner Veltliner.
All right. I have to leave now. We've got Sarah Schneider from Sunset Magazine coming up next. What a pleasure it's been to be with you today. We've got to spend some quality time here.
Thank you very much, David. And please say hi to Sarah. She has been a very good friend of mine, a special friend for 20 years. And I wish I was able to see her. So they have a beautiful magazine, great people, and good luck with...
Well, you can see her. Just walk on over here. She'll be here in just a second. We will be back with Sarah Schneider, but want to say goodbye to Christian Roganot, who is just such a fine winemaker and such a wealth of knowledge. As a plane sails above us, full of paparazzi, we'll be back with more Grape Encounters right after this. With Grape Encounters Radio, and now I'm with the very young and lovely Sarah Schneider, wine editor of Sunset Magazine. And I say that because we're going to talk about wine that is older than her.
Which I knew means, it was relative.
Which means young wine, right?
Very. Oh, very.
Sarah, I want to talk about old wine today.
Okay.
Because every once in a while, you and I, actually, you get to do this more than I get to, I think. We get to drink wine that has been aging for a really long time. Let's
once
say 40, 50 years. Yeah. Those very coveted bottles of wine that people have meticulously maintained, they've babied them for decades. And then finally, there's a reason to open them up, and we get to drink something that's 50 years old. The expectation is that that wine is going to be just crazy delicious because it's been aging all those decades.
Well, that's the cliche. I mean, we all know, oh, older wine, old wine, fantastic, it's delicious. But is it?
And you said that's the cliche. How many times have you seen that cliche on birthday cards and, you know, jokes? And, you know, we always talk about aging like fine wine.
Right.
Isn't that funny? And the truth of the matter is that, ladies and gentlemen, despite the fact that Sarah and I know a lot of you, get to drink some really old wine, an awful lot of old wine tastes like old wine. That's
well,
what it tastes
does.
Like.
It does. And I'm thinking that it's really complicated as to where this, oh, I'm not going to call it a myth, as in not true, because I've had some really astonishingly good old wine. But the fact that wines need to age as a principle is almost based on the times, earlier times, when maybe things didn't get quite as ripe. And wine that was just made and aged long enough to get in the bottle and released was a little harsh. So yeah, you needed to give that wine some time.
So who do you think figured out that if you let a bottle sit for a while, that it was going to get better? I mean, you know, because conventional wisdom would say, let's drink this as soon as possible. We like things fresh. I think human beings love fresh stuff, right?
Right.
So who is the person that said, hey, let's just put that in the cellar for 20 years and then we'll try it. It'll maybe be better then.
Wouldn't that be a good story to find out? I should know that.
That's why I brought this topic up, because I was positive you would know that.
It
and,
must have
and
been,
boy, do I feel disappointed. But old wine, it's what I think is fascinating about the whole idea of old wine is that if you take a place that you and I are very familiar with, Napa and Sonoma, let's say, those wine regions, while they've made wine there for a very long time, It wasn't really until the 60s and 70s mm-hmm. that they did it with fervor, you know, where it really started to explode as an industry.
Right.
And so there is a lot of wine in existence from those days. And let's say 1967, all right, this is 2017. How many years ago is that? Is that 50 years?
That's 50 years.
Okay, so that's 50 years ago. So there are wines, and I had a wine that was given to me by Michael Mondavi.
Excuse me, 60 years.
Oh, 60 years. Yeah, okay. So Michael Mondavi gave me a bottle of wine that was actually 60 years old, and I was really excited to drink it. And the thing is that it was exciting to taste it, and it's always exciting to taste those, but generally speaking, they do taste old.
Was that a Robert Mondavi wine?
Well, it wasn't. It was Charles Krug.
Charles Krug, family.
That was a Charles Krug wine, and it was actually Cesare Mondavi.
Sure.
His grandpa.
Michael's grandfather
that owned that winery originally.
That is really interesting because it was actually in the mid-60s, and you're getting to the late 60s there with that wine. In a large part, it was Robert Mondavi himself who woke up the wine industry that had been sleeping still since Prohibition.
Right.
And so he actually brought in techniques from the old world and along with other current innovative winemakers like Andrei Chelyachev, who really taught the whole Napa Valley how to make wine. Those were the years into the 70s when they were finally making really good wine. And again, it probably wasn't quite as ripe as today's wines, and it was built to age with enough acidity and solid tannin and good fruit. But to your point, those old wines can stay fresh for quite a long while, but they aren't a profile that we're used to. They take on, after those first robust fruit flavors start fading a little bit, they get these secondary flavors and then tertiary flavors of, you know, dried flowers and nuts and caramelized things and dried fruit as opposed to that fresh fruit.
Yeah, the thing that a lot of people, I think, fail to realize is that wine is a living thing.
Right.
And it's living in the bottle and it's evolving and it's changing the time.
And not everybody likes that profile. I mean, it can be absolutely beautiful, but it's an old wine.
So here's the interesting question. If we compared an inexpensive bulk wine made today to a wine that was made 50 years ago in a young wine region, you know, say Napa, Sonoma, would that wine measure up to the old wine? Because winemaking has improved so much over the decades that it begs the question, what is the difference in quality between what we make now for $10 a bottle versus what we made then for what would have been a higher price equivalence?
Such a good question. I would actually answer it two ways. I think that a majority of wine drinkers now, if it's a decent bulk wine, because we, as you say, know how to make good wine at all price points, I think the majority of wine drinkers would actually prefer that over the more expensive aged wine. But I would say that if you drink through the years, you actually develop a taste for some of those characteristics that come through in the older wines, and that the good wines that have the bones to age, they come from really superior vineyards, they have structure, they have minerality, they have acidity, and they have quality fruit, that those bones are going to come through and you can appreciate them unless the wine has completely died, which I've had too.
And one of the things that I really enjoy about drinking old wine is that I always try to put myself into the time period, when the wine was made. That, you know, this wine was made the year that President Kennedy was shot. And then when you think about what life was like then and how much history has transpired and how this wine has survived all that, and there's nothing in the world that you would ever consume, that you would ever put in your body, that you would swallow that's that old. You know, you wouldn't go into the refrigerator and pull out a Big Mac that had been made 50 years ago. But yet we relish the opportunity to have this wine. And you have to put it in perspective and drink it as a living piece of history, not simply as something to drink, because that's not what it's about. All right. So what I think we should do is let everybody go do what they do and have a wonderful day today. And Sarah and I are going to go do what we do which we do it just for you. It's not for ourselves. We do this selflessly. We drink really fine wine so that we can make your life a better place to live. And that's what we're going to do. That's going to do it for Grape Encounters today. That's going to do it for Sipping with Sarah. And we will see you back here next week, same time, same channel, on this awesome radio station.